abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Wednesday, February 26th, 2014. We have got some interesting history for you guys to chew on today. If you are a longtime listener of this program, you may recall that I mentioned that in February, there would take place, as usual every year, the Austrian Student Scholars Conference at Grove City College, and I was going to be speaking there as one of the plenary speakers. And I noted that if you were a grad student or even an undergrad who had a paper that you might want to deliver at a conference like this, you should do so. It's a great opportunity to get a conference presentation under your belt. Well, then, if you're also a regular listener of this program, you'll recall that they give cash prizes for the three best papers. And I noted to you that a listener of this program happened to be a graduate student at Cal State Fullerton, and who called up and said, I do have a paper, and he was invited to come give it, and he wound up winning the first place prize of $1,000. Absolutely great. Well, he's our guest today, Daniel Barbeau, and he's going to talk about his paper, which I found very interesting, on a topic I didn't know anything about. Like, I'm Mr. Nullification. I have a book called Nullification. I wrote up the Nullification FAQ, nullificationfaq.com, and I did not know about what California and then other states did during the Civil War, they basically nullified the greenbacks. They didn't want to accept the crummy inflationary paper currency being put out by the U.S. government. It's a very interesting and hardly told story, and it's the type of story you're only going to hear on this kind of program right here, the Tom Woods Show that you love so much, I dearly hope. Stay tuned after my conversation with Daniel for a couple quick announcements about not only where I'm going to be, but what the upcoming programs are. Oh boy, are you in for a treat. But right now, let's welcome Daniel Barbeau. Daniel, thanks for being here today.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, this is very exciting that the winning paper now is featured here on the program. But what an interesting subject it is. And I have to say, if I had known about this, I would have included it in my book, Nullification. But I didn't know anything about it until I read about it here in your paper. Now, for one thing, before we get into the details, is this something you're intending to publish somewhere, or are you going to put some kind of maybe a briefer version online for people to read? What are your plans with it?
You know, I'd like to do that eventually. In the time being, I'm working on as a master's thesis. So down the line, I'd like to get out there and publish. I think it's an interesting enough topic, and there's enough information on it that it's definitely something I think people would be interested in.
All right, so I sort of set this up a little bit for people before bringing you on, but let's take it just step by step here, and let's explain, first of all, what exactly the greenbacks were, what distinguishing features did they have, and why were they issued?
Well, to be able to understand that, you need to go back a little bit even further to the beginning of the war. You know, the beginning of the Civil War, in about 1861, 1862, the financial system that supported the federal government really came to a grinding halt because of the amount of debt that was being issued. You know, the war was costing about $2 million a day, and that's just something that the financial system just couldn't handle. And so there were, in response to that, the federal government passed a few, I guess, financial wartime reformation bill. You know, first was the Legal Tender Act of 1862, and that act set up the legal framework to be issuing greenbacks. Greenbacks were debt. They were debt that paid no interest, And that might sound funny to us now, but you kind of have to take the conceptual leap that people saw Greenback at the time, and that's why they were so controversial, too, is that, you know, people traded bonds in the market somewhat like we do currency today. But they were always redeemable in gold, and they always bore interest. And with greenbacks, they are specifically set that really had no interest on the holder, and it was not redeemable in gold anymore because gold redemption had been suspended in 1862.
Why do you describe them as debt rather than as a currency? Because they're being used as a medium of exchange.
Yes, they were issued as a debt bearing no interest, and that was what was extremely controversial about them at the time. So it's a different. People at the time they conceived of the greenback as a bond that bore no interest. It's a different kind of conceptual paradigm that people had about money in that time than we do now. Now I think if you went up to the average person, talked to them, you know, what does a dollar represent in your wallet? They would say, oh, that equals out to, you know, 10 minutes of my time at work or something like that. But people conceived of these things, they conceived of currency differently than we do today.
Okay, so the federal government issues them presumably because they can't pay everything they want to pay for the war, so they have to resort to a mechanism like this. And what would be the problem with that from the point of view of the average person or of California in general or any of these other states that eventually get in on this? What's wrong with them? I mean, this is the means that the government has chosen to use to cope with the financial stress of the war. What's wrong with it?
Well, there was another provision in the Legal Tender Act, which was radical, too, for its time. That was the provision in the title, creating greenbacks as legal tender. Other circulating currency at the time, too, bonds, obviously, they were not legal tender. So vendors and consumers were not legally obliged to use them as they were after the Legal Tender Act of 1862. Now you have a greenback, and people are legally obliged to use this, to accept this currency in exchange. And so what you're kind of getting at is, yes, you're right. The federal government had to issue these basically to pay for the war effort. Now, people in California were understandably upset about this more than other parts of the country. You know, California was separated by thousands of miles. This is before the Transcontinental Railroads. This is before the Panama Canal. So you always had to keep in mind the geographic isolation of California during this time. Getting back to a little bit of how Californians and people in the West they responded to this, there was a court case, and it got all the way up to the California Supreme Court. It was Perry versus Washburn, 1862, less than a year after the passage of the Legal Tender Act. And in this court case, Washburn, the defendant, he was a municipal tax collector in San Francisco. And Perry tried to pay his taxes in greenbacks in San Francisco. And you have the tax collector saying, no, I'm not going to, we're not, the city of San Francisco refuses your greenbacks. We will only collect your city taxes in gold or silver. And this case actually was decided in the favor of Washburn. And so what this case did was it allowed California state officials to collect taxes in gold and silver and not the greenback.
So California, as an entity, is not accepting the greenback or not interested in taking the greenback. They want gold and silver. So then
exactly.
What happens for ordinary individuals? Does this principle get extended to them?
Yes, it does. They really extend the same principle that the state government has really assumed, that it doesn't have to accept greenbacks. And mind you, this time, too, the greenbacks are rapidly falling in value, especially during the early years of the war when there are a lot of northern reversals. And so the greenback is falling to 80, 70 cents on the dollar, even lower than that later on. But what the California legislature does in 1863 is pass a statute called the Specific Contract Act. And what this does, it allows anybody to, or any private parties to create contracts in any denomination they want. It could be silver, gold, greenbacks, foreign currency. It just has to be stated within the contract. So right there, you have a California or a state, you know, de facto nullifying the Legal Tender Act, the legal tender provision of the Legal Tender Act.
All right, let me make sure everybody's following along. So legal tender laws say that such and such type of money has to be accepted. By
Correct.
Law, you have got to accept it. Whereas California is saying, if you want to use the greenback, go ahead, but we're not going to force you. You can make a contract with somebody to be paid in whatever you two mutually agree upon. Now, that runs counter to the Legal Tender Act because it's not saying that any particular thing, especially in this case, obviously, the greenbacks, has to be accepted. So that's the key here.
Yes, that is correct.
Does California take this position because it has a well-thought-out theory of money, inflation, or whatever, or does it have a more petty motivation? Like, why are they doing this? Are they really standing on principle? And if so, do they ever expressly state that principle?
Well, you know, they were, their biggest fear was inflation. And you know, they would always, actually, you look at the contemporary accounts, and they were always mentioning, hey, look at the East, you know, they are experiencing horrible inflation. Inflation was in the Union within up to like 60, 70, 80% during the war years. And they would, you know, they would, in California, were really congratulating themselves during the time, saying, look, gosh, at least we avoided this inflation issue. You know, and if, what's interesting is they're making the same arguments about inflation, you know, that inflation is going to skew the things in the economy. It's going to hurt people on fixed incomes and those kind of things that people make today about inflation. So really, and not only that, they were afraid about what really struck them as odd and they were fearful of about paper currency is that a lot of these, you know, a lot of Californians at the time, almost everybody was an immigrant or migrant to California, and coming from other parts of the country. And they had a long experience with paper money through what they called wildcat banks, which were banks that were chartered by states, and they often issued tons of credit with very little capitalization behind it. And these were reformed and, you know, pretty much done away with by some of the National Banking Acts during the Civil War. But people still had those memories, and they still had the memories of being flooded with paper currency, and they really feared the same kind of outcome in California and the rest of the country, for that matter, too. And I think they really feared, too, was the institution of a legal tender. That's more than anything what they were really worried about, because they really saw legal tender as a true government overreach, a really scary power that the federal government could assume.
Well, that really is the key to the whole scheme, because if you can't force people to accept your inflationary paper, then it can't do the damage to the people that it would otherwise do. And, of course, it can't bring in the benefits to the government that it would otherwise bring if people aren't forced to take it. So the linchpin of the thing is the legal tender aspect. This isn't just some little lawyer's detail of the matter. This is the heart of the whole question. Now, in your paper, you point out that this sort of rebellion against the greenbacks does not stay confined to California.
No. It does not. Within a few years, within about 1 or 2 years after California started this legal rebellion against the greenback, you had other states jumping in there too. You had states like Oregon and Nevada and some of the neighboring territories like Washington, Idaho, Montana, Colorado, and Utah all instituted some form of another a legal tender, or excuse me, a specific contract act or clause within their laws that protected people to be able to make contracts in whatever monetary medium they desired.
Now, did the federal government realize this is going on? I mean, did they respond in some way? Was there any way that these states suffered as a result of this? Or what were the long-run consequences of it?
Well, you know, they were fortunate, I guess you could say, in their distance and isolation and the fact that the government really had better things to do than try to change the legal tender laws of the Western states. So, you know, geographic isolation protected them in one measure. But, you know, the federal government, they were not happy. They were definitely not happy about this situation that was going on. Some of the newspapers from the East, they would call California that, you know, these were nullifiers as rank as South Carolina. And they would just, you know, accuse them of being copperheads and secessionists, et cetera. But, you know, that really wasn't true. People in California and the West, they were overwhelmingly pro-union and you know, anti-secessionist. And they certainly did not support the Southern war effort during the Civil War. You know, an interesting side note to this whole story is that in 1863, there was actually a scandal in the California Assembly when the state treasurer paid, or at least attempted to pay, the federal government their apportioned tax load in greenbacks, because he had collected this taxes in gold, transferred them into greenbacks, and then tried to keep the difference for the state treasury. And that was such a scandal, because the California legislature says, look, you know, we are loyal unionists. We are loyal Americans. You know, you're trying to stiff the federal government here of the difference, because remember, there's a market difference between the gold and the greenbacks, which are falling in value. You know, you're trying to stiff the federal government with that difference. We need to be able to pay our, I hate this terminology, but fair share of federal taxes to help with the war effort.
Isn't that funny? That I mean, to me, that's just clearly schizophrenic. Because if you want to help with the war effort, you accept the crummy, depreciating paper.
Yeah, you'd think so, huh? No, and actually, the sub-treasurer in San Francisco, the representative of the federal government, he said, no, we're not accepting this paper. I'm not going to accept legal tender of the United States. I want the gold.
You point out here that eventually the Supreme Court takes on this question. Now, the Supreme Court is all over the place in the 19th century in terms of money decisions. But there was one halfway decent decision that in retrospect, or in some ways retroactively, kind of vindicated what California did. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, there's two cases you could really identify that upheld this Monte Rebellion that California was leading. The first was Bronson v. Rhodes in 1868, and that upheld in the United States Supreme Court the legality of the California specific contract law. And ironically, it was Salmon Chase who wrote the majority decision, who was the Chief Justice, affirming the legality of California specific contract law, and who was also, back during the war, the U.S. Treasurer, Secretary of the Treasury, who was the father of the Greenback, who's the father of the National Banking Act and the Legal Tender Act. So right here, he's really striking down his own creation of the Greenback. But they upheld the legality of California's specific contract law for a few reasons. They upheld it, but they also upheld it nationwide. So they overturned any other laws or any federal prohibitions against having contracts in currency other than greenbacks. And finally, in 1878, there was a second case, and this went even further, called Hepburn versus Griswold. And this case overturned the entire structure that the Legal Tender Act and greenbacks were based on. And they really overturned it for a few reasons. First, found that the Constitution forbid the issuance of paper money. There's always a debate whether that provision was just oriented for the state. Right, this is a section, Article 1, Section 9 prohibition, whether that was just directed to the states or whether that was directed to the federal government also. That was an ongoing issue in contention during that era. It also said that legal tender acts violated the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause because of inflation. Now you have, because you would have legal tender inflating, and that would be an unjust taking of the property that was not allowed under the Fifth Amendment.
Ah, interesting, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, inflation is theft, recognized by the Supreme Court.
How about that? Okay, and then was there one other thing?
Oh, yes. Sorry. The last reason was it was inconsistent with the Constitution because the Legal Tender Act impaired contracts. And, of course, the Constitution forbids the government impairing contracts. And by legally changing, let's say you had a contract in 1855, in a mortgage, let's say, by legally changing the terms of that mortgage from gold to greenbacks, that's an impairment of contracts. That's what the Supreme Court decided also.
All right, well, I'm a little bit nervous here because I actually am finding myself in complete agreement with the Supreme Court. maybe we need to cut the conversation here. Well, yeah, let me ask you, what do you think is the long-term significance of this? I mean, some people would look at this and say, well, this is an obscure monetary debate from the 1860s and 70s, but I think your view is that there might be something of longer-run significance happening there.
Well, as a disclaimer, soon after the Hepburn decision, the Supreme Court, like you said, reversed itself and decided that everything it had just decided was null and void and went back. But by that time, dollar to gold presumption was coming back into law. So in 1879, that was almost became like a moot point because the United States was going back onto the gold standard, which it had left from 1862 to 1879. But as far as long-term consequences, you know, there is, I guess you could say, a lot of history since then. But I do think that you could also say, you know, that the future of a monetary system is not necessarily based on government legal tender laws. And you could say that in the future, you know, you could see a more decentralized monetary system, you know, with competing currencies, which is what happened during that era, too. Whether that be something like Bitcoin or some kind of other alternative, you know, it is interesting, too, to see whether or not, you know, Bitcoins or something like that would be included in any kind of legal tender provisions, you know, and those kind of things, as long as these laws remain in effect, you know, in my opinion, probably, you know, remain at the mercy of federal indifference.
Well, I look at this and I just think of it in terms of something more broad. This is just the general story of state-level resistance to some federal initiative that they consider to be unconstitutional. Now, I don't know, on the other hand, now I can see that they would have done this because they're concerned about inflation, but as I said that just now, I have to admit, I don't know if they made a constitutional argument in California or if it was entirely an economic argument based on fears of inflation. What do you know about this?
Well, they made both arguments.
Okay.
You know, they were very, I guess you could say, pragmatic, saying that in utilitarian arguments, saying, hey, we don't want the ill effects of inflation, but and also they made the constitutional argument, too, that this is against the spirit, if not the word, of the Constitution. You know, they even reached back into, you know, the constitutional debates, you know, and the arguments and the conversations going on when Madison and those guys were drafting the Constitution in 1787. They even went back into there to really try to figure out the intent. They were real original intentist kind of legal scholar or legal mind. And that's what they were really searching for.
Well, this to me, this is just such a, I was going to say a gold mine that you've dug up, and I don't mean that in any pun. But seriously, this is a great piece of work that you've done. Does this have any connection with the, are you in a doctoral program or just a master's program?
I'm in a master's program right now, and I'm transforming this into my master's thesis, so it should be significantly more than, I think, what you're looking at now, because I think you have the paper in its original form. So.
Right. Yes, indeed, I do. Well, listen, I appreciate your time today. I mean, this is a item that I don't think anybody is going to be reporting on or telling people about. You just did it, and you've got a great paper here, and we look forward to seeing more on this and maybe a blog post summarizing the ideas of it or something, because I'd like to have something to be able to link people to. But it's just been great having a chance to have basically the country's foremost expert on this subject come on here and share some information with us. So thanks a lot.
Well, thanks, Thomas. Thanks for having me on. I hope it's a topic that people find interesting, and it's a definitely historic nugget that most people don't even realize is out there.
Well, thanks again, Daniel. All right, everybody, let's talk a little bit about what we're going to be doing on this program later this week and into next week. But first, let me just run down where I'm going to be. A couple of little modifications here. You know, on Saturday, I'll be in Idaho, Twin Falls, the College of Southern Idaho. That's Saturday, pretty much the whole day. I'll be speaking toward the end of the day, but the whole day is going to be wonderful. But the previous day now, February 28th, we've added a little meet and greet at my hotel. So you can get the details on that on my website, tomwoods.com, my personal site, tomwoods.com/events. We're going to be there with some Liberty candidates. We'll have some food. It'll be fun. So check that out. So the 28th and the 1st. And if you have a ticket for the event on March 1st, then you can get in on the 28th for free. Then March 5th, Topeka, Kansas at Washburn University. March 15th, the University of Central Arkansas. Got to get tickets for that, so make sure and sign up at tomwoods.com/events. You'll find the details there. April 9th, Florida Southern College in Lakeland, Florida. And April 10th in Lynchburg, Virginia, I'll be at Liberty University. Then it looks like we're adding an event. I don't have the date absolutely finalized, but probably in May in Utah. We're going to be talking about this whole NSA thing right there in the belly of the beast itself. So that's that. Now, in terms of what's coming up later this week, tomorrow we're going to talk to Josh Taylor from the incredibly successful internet comedy team, Blimey Cow, and they are wonderful Ron Paulian people, so that's another great reason to watch them and listen to them. But we'll talk about not only what they do and how great they are at it, but also about how you too can start up a YouTube channel and be successful, because man, have they ever been successful. Then Friday, remember Scott Horton? Like the best guest you've ever heard? Like he's unbelievably great? Well, he's coming back to join us on Friday for a little foreign policy perspective. Then next week, all kinds of great stuff. We've got the author of a brand new book on the reality of Sweden and Denmark and Norway. Not the cutesy little, these are the best countries in the world stuff that you read in the papers, but the reality of what's going on over there. That's going to be great. Then we're talking to Steve Hogarth of Marillion. If you don't know what I'm talking about, then go to tomwoods.com, not Tom Woods Radio, tomwoods.com/Hogarth, and check it out for yourself. Tuesday of next week will be 10th or Tuesday with Michael Bolden of the 10th Amendment Center, who has been getting enormous publicity for all the various efforts against the NSA. We'll get an update from him, plus more next week, and I'm trying to work to get you guys a super-duper special guest, but I'll keep that a secret until it's all lined up. So thank you guys for listening. Thanks for supporting us at no cost to yourself through your purchases through our Amazon widget at tomwoodsradio.com, and we will see you guys tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.